Garrigan had seen his grandmother, or her image, several times. But the similarity of her features to Aunt Paul's seemed uncanny. There were differences, of course. Aunt Paul's hair, except for that white lock at her brow, was dark, almost black, and her eyes were a deep, deep blue. Poledra, on the other hand, had tawny hair, hovering nearly on the verge of being as blonde as velvet's, and her eyes were as golden as the eyes of a wolf. The features of the two women, however, were almost identical, as had been the one time Garion had seen her image, the features of Aunt Paul's sister, Belgaran. Belgarath, his wife, and his daughter had withdrawn to the far side of the room, and Belden, his tears glistening through his scowl, had placed himself squarely between them and the others in the room to guard their privacy during their reunion.
"Who is she?"
Zakath asked Garion in puzzlement.
"She's my grandmother," Garion replied simply. "Belgarath's wife."
"He did not know he had a wife."
"Where did you think Aunt Paul came from?"
"I guess I had not thought of that."
Zakath looked around, noting that both Tenedra and Velvet were dabbing at their eyes with wispy little handkerchiefs.
"Why is everyone so misty-eyed?"
"We all thought that she had died in childbirth when Aunt Paul and her sister Belderan were born."
"And how long ago was that?"
"Aunt Paul is over 3,000 years old," Garion shrugged.
Zakath began to tremble.
"And Belgarath's been grieving all that time?"
"Yes."
Garion did not really want to talk just then. All he wanted to do was to drink in the radiant faces of his family. The word came to him unbidden, and he suddenly remembered that bleak time after he had first learned that Aunt Paul was not, strictly speaking, his aunt. He had felt then so terribly alone, an orphan, in the most dreadful sense of the word. It had taken years, but now everything was all right. His family was nearly complete. Belgarath, Poledra, and Aunt Paul did not speak, for speech was largely unnecessary. Instead, they simply sat in chairs drawn closely together, gazing into each other's faces and holding hands. Garion could only faintly begin to understand the intensity of their emotions. He did not, however, feel cut off from them, but rather seemed somehow to share their joy. Durnick crossed the room to the rest of them. Even solid, practical Durnick's eyes shone with unshed tears.
"Why don't we leave them alone?"
he suggested.
"It's a good time to get the packing done, anyway. We have a ship to catch, you know."
"She said you knew,"
Tenedra said accusingly to Garion when they had returned to their room.
"Yes," he admitted.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"She asked me to keep it to myself."
"That doesn't apply to your own wife, Garion."
"It doesn't?" he asked in feigned surprise. "When did they pass that rule?"
"I just made it up," she admitted. "Oh, Garion,"
she said then, throwing her arms about his neck and kissing him.
"I do love you."
"I certainly hope so. Shall we pack?"
The corridors of the royal palace here in Perivor were cool as Garion and Tenedra returned to the central room, and the arched embrasures admitted golden morning sunlight as if even the elements were bestowing a benediction on what was, after all, a special, even sacred day. When they had all gathered once again, Belgarath and his wife and daughter had composed themselves enough so that they welcomed company.
"Would you like to have me introduce them, Mother?" Aunt Paul asked.
"I know all of them, Polgara,"
Poledra replied.
I've been with you for quite some time, remember? Why didn't you tell me? I wanted to see if you could figure it out for yourself. You disappointed me just a bit, Polgara.
Mother, Aunt Paul protested. Not in front of the children. They both laughed that same warm, rich laugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, Polgara said then, this is my mother, Poledra.
They crowded around the tawny-haired legend. Silk extravagantly kissed her hand.
I suppose, Lady Poledra, he said slyly, we should congratulate Belgarath. All things considered, I think you got the worst of that bargain.
Your daughter's been trying to reform him for about 3 eons now, without notable success.
Poledra smiled.
One has perhaps greater resources at one's command than one's daughter, Prince Keldar.
She lapsed, it seemed, unconsciously into her previous mode of speech.
All right, Poledra, Belden growled, stumping forward. What really happened? After the girls were born, our master came to us and told us that you were no longer with us. We all thought he meant that you had died. The twins cried for 2 straight months, and that left me to try to cope with the babies. What really happened?
Aldor did not lie to you, Belden, she replied calmly. In a very real sense, I was no longer with you. You see, shortly after the girls were born, Aldor and Ul came to me. They said they had a great task for me, but that it would involve an equally great sacrifice. I would have to leave you all behind to prepare for the task. At first I refused, but when they explained the task to me, I had no choice but to agree. I turned my back on the veil and went with Ul to Prolgu to receive instruction. From time to time he would relent and let me go unobserved out into the world to see how my family was doing.
She looked rather firmly at Belgarath.
You and I have much to discuss, old wolf, she told him.
Belgarath winced.
I don't suppose you could give us some enlightenment about this momentous task,
Sadi suggested mildly.
I'm afraid not.
I didn't think so, the eunuch murmured.
Eriand,
Poledra said then, greeting the blonde-haired young man.
Poledra,
he responded. Eriand, as always, seemed unsurprised by this turn of events. Eriand, Geryon had noticed, was never surprised.
You have grown since we last met, she noted. I suppose I have,
he agreed.
Are you ready?
The question sent a chill through Geryon, as he suddenly remembered the strange dream he had had the night before his true identity had been revealed. There was a polite knock on the door. Dornick answered it and found an armored knight standing outside.
His Majesty hath dispatched me to advise thee and thy companions that thy ship awaiteth thee in the harbor, my lord, the knight said.
I'm not a... Dornick started.
Let it lie, Dornick, Silk told him.
Sir Knight, he said to the armored man at the door.
Where might we find his Majesty? We would take our leave of him and thank him for his many kindnesses.
His Majesty doth await thee and thy companions at the harbor, my lord. He would bid ye all farewell there and see ye off on the great adventure with doth lie in store for ye.
We will make haste then, Sir Knight, the little man promised. It were discourteous of us, in the extreme, to keep one of the paramount monarchs of the world awaiting our arrival. Thou hast performed thine appointed task in a manner which does thee credit, Sir Knight, and we are all in thy debt.
The knight bowed, beaming. Then he went back down the hallway.
Where did you ever learn to speak like that, Keldar?
Velvet asked in some surprise. Oh, dear lady, Silk replied with outrageous extravagance. Knowest thou not that the poet doth lurk beneath the most common exterior? An it please thee, I will deliver unto thee fulsome compliments upon thine every ravishing and unsurpassed part. He eyed her up and down suggestively.
Keldar,
she exclaimed, blushing bright red. That's sort of fun, you know, Silk said, referring to the archaic speech. At least Garion hoped that was what he was referring to. Once you learn how to wrap your tongue around the haths and doths, and for as much as... It has a certain ring and cadence to it, doesn't it? We are surrounded by charlatans, mother, Polgara sighed.
Belgarath, Durnick said seriously. There's not much point in taking the horses, is there? What I mean is that we're going to be clambering over rocks and wading in surf when we get to the reef. Wouldn't the horses just be in the way?
You're probably right, Durnick,
the old man agreed.
I'll go down to the stables and talk with the grooms, the smith said. The rest of you go on ahead. I'll catch up.
He turned and left the room. An eminently practical man, Poledra observed. The poet, however, doth lurk beneath that most practical of exteriors, mother, Polgara smiled. And thou wouldst not believe how much pleasure I take in that aspect of him. I think it's time for us to get off this island, old wolf, Poledra said wryly. 2 more days, and they will all be sitting around composing bad poetry. Servants arrived then to carry their packs to the harbor, and Garion and his companions trooped through the halls of the palace and out into the streets of Dal Perivor. Although the morning had dawned bright and sunny, a bank of heavy clouds had begun to build up off to the west, heavy purple clouds that spoke eloquently of the likelihood of bad weather over Corim. I suppose we should have known, Silk sighed. Once, just once, I'd like to see one of these stupendous events happen in good weather. Garion fully understood what lay behind the apparently light-hearted banter. None of them approached tomorrow without a certain apprehension. The pronouncement Saradas had made at Rehan that one of them would not survive the meeting lay heavily on each of their minds, and in the fashion as old as man himself, each tried to make light of his fears. That reminded him of something, and he dropped back to have a word with the seeress of Kel. Saradas, he said to the blindfolded girl, should Zakath and I wear our armor when we get to the reef? He plucked at the front of the doublet he had put on, with some relief that morning, in the hope that he might never again be obliged to encase himself in steel. What I'm getting at is that if the meeting is going to be entirely spiritual, there's no real need for it, is there? But if there's a possibility of some fighting, we should probably be prepared, shouldn't we?
Thou art as transparent as glass, Balgarian of Riva,
she said, chiding him gently.
Thou thinkest to trick answers from me to questions which I am forbidden to discuss with thee. Do as it pleaseth thee, King of Riva. Prudence, however, doth suggest that a bit of steel here and there in thine apparel might not be inappropriate when approaching a situation where surprises might await thee.
I will be guided by thee, Garion grinned. Thy prudent advice seemeth to me the course of wisdom.
Makest thou a rather feeble attempt at humor, Belgarion?
Would I do that, holy seeress? He grinned at her, and strode back to where Belgarath and Poledra walked hand in hand, just behind Zakath and Sadi. Grandfather, I think I just managed to sneak an answer out of Zaradis, he said.
That might be a first, the old man replied.
I think there might be some fighting when we get to the reef. I asked her if Sakath and I should wear armor when we get there. She didn't answer me directly, but she said that it might not be a bad idea, just in case.
You might want to pass that on to the others. Let's not have them walking into something blind.
I'll do that.
The king, along with most of his gaily clad court, awaited them on a long wharf extending out into the choppy waters of the harbor. Despite the temperate morning, the king wore an ermine robe and a heavy gold crown.
Gladly do I greet thee and thy noble companions, Belgarion of Riva, he declaimed. And in sadness do I await thy departure. Many here have pled with me that I might permit them also to speak to this matter. But in thy behalf I have steadfastly refused such permission, knowing full well the urgency of thy quest.
Thou art a true and faithful friend, your majesty, Geryon said with genuine gratitude at being spared a morning of windy speeches.
He clasped the king's hand warmly. Know that if the gods grant us victory on the morrow, we will return straightway to this happy isle, so that we may more fulsomely express our gratitude to thee and the members of thy court, who have all treated us with such noble courtesy.
Besides, they had to come back for the horses anyway.
And now, your majesty, our fate awaits us. We must, with scant and niggard farewell, take ship to go forth with resolute hearts to meet that fate. An it please the gods, we shall return anon. Goodbye, my friend.
Fare thee well, Belgarion of Riva,
the king said in a voice near to tears.
May the gods grant thee and thy companions victory.
Pray that it may be so.
Geryon turned with a rather melodramatic swirl of his cloak and led his friends up the gangway. He glanced back over his shoulder and saw Durnik pushing his way through the crowd. That would help. As soon as the smith was on board, Geryon could give the order to cast off all lines and thus avoid the necessity of more extended farewells shouted across the ship's rail. Directly behind Durnik came the several carts carrying their packs. Their belongings were quickly transferred to the ship, and Geryon went aft to speak with the captain, a grizzled old seaman with a weathered face. Unlike Western vessels, whose bare plank decks were usually hoodie-stoned into some semblance of whiteness, the quarterdeck and its surrounding railings were finished with a dark, glossy varnish, and snowy ropes hung in neat coils from highly polished belaying pins. The effect was almost ostentatiously neat, evidence that the vessel's master took great pride in his ship. The captain, himself, wore a somewhat weathered blue doublet. He was, after all, in port. A jaunty velvet cap was cocked rakishly over one of his ears.
"I guess that's everything, Captain," Geryon said. "We may as well cast off and get clear of the harbor before the tide turns."
"You've been to sea before, I see, young master," the captain said approvingly. "I hope your friends have as well. It's always a trial to have landsmen aboard. I never seem to realize that throwing up into the wind isn't a good idea."
He raised his voice to an ear-splitting bellow.
"Cast off all lines! Prepare to make sail!"
"Your speech doesn't seem to be that of the island, captain," Geryon observed.
"I'd be surprised if it were, young master. I'm from the Melsine Islands. About 20 years ago, there were some ugly rumors about me being circulated in some quarters back home, so I thought it might be prudent to absent myself for a while. I came here. You wouldn't believe what these people were calling a ship when I got here."
"Sort of like a sea-going castle?" Geryon suggested.
"You've seen them, then?"
"In another part of the world."
"Make sail!"
the captain roared at his crew.
"There, young master," he grinned at Geryon. "I'll have you out of earshot in no time at all. That should spare us all that drasty eloquence. Where was I? Oh, yes. When I got here, the ships of Perivor were so top-heavy that a good sneeze would capsize them. Would you believe it only took me 5 years to explain that to these people?"
"You must have been amazingly eloquent, Captain," Geryon laughed.
"About or two with belaying pins helped a bit," the captain conceded. "Finally, I had to issue a challenge, though. None of these blockheads can refuse a challenge. So I proposed a race around the island. 20 ships started out, and only mine finished. They started listening about then. I spent the next 5 years in the yards, supervising construction. Then the king finally let me go back to sea. I got me a baronetcy out of it. Oh, not that it matters. I think I've even got a castle somewhere."
A brazen blast came from the wharf as, in true Mimbrate fashion, the knights of the king's court saluted them on their horns.
"Isn't that pitiful?" the captain said. "I don't think there's a man on the whole island who can carry a tune."
He looked appraisingly at Geryon.
"I heard tell that you are making for the Turim Reef."
"Corim Reef," Geryon corrected absently.
"You've been listening to the landsmen, I see. They can't even pronounce the name right. Anyway, before you get your mindset in stone about where you want to land, send for me. There's some very ugly water around that reef. It's not the sort of place you want to make mistakes. And I've got some fairly accurate charts."
"The king told us there weren't any charts of the reef." The captain winked slyly.
"The rumors I mentioned earlier stirred some ship captains to try to follow me," he admitted. "Although chase would probably be a more accurate word. Rewards cause that sort of thing sometimes. Anyhow, I was passing near the reef in calm weather once, and I decided to take some soundings. It never hurts to have a place to hide, where others are afraid to follow you."
"What is your name, Captain?" Geryon asked him.
"Kreska, young master."
"I think we can drop that. Geryon will do just fine."
"Whatever you like, Geryon. Now get off my quarterdeck so I can maneuver this old tub out of the harbor."
The speech was different, and it was halfway around the world. But Captain Kreska was so much like Barak's friend Greldik that Geryon felt suddenly very secure. He went below to join the others. "We've had a bit of luck," he told them. "Our captain is a Malsine. He's not overburdened with scruples, but he has got charts of the reef. He's probably the only man in these waters who does. He's offered to advise us when the time comes to decide on where we want to land."
"That was helpful of him," Silk said.
"Maybe. But I think his main concern is not ripping the bottom out of his ship."
"I can relate to that," Silk said. "As long as I'm on board, anyway."
"I'm going back up on deck," Geryon said then. "Staying in a stuffy compartment on the first day of a voyage always makes me a little queasy for some reason."
"And you are the ruler of an island?" Poledra said.
"It's just a question of getting adjusted, Grandmother."
"Of course."
The sea and sky were unsettled. The heavy cloud bank was still coming in from the west, sending long, ponderous combers rolling in from that direction, waves that had, in all probability, started somewhere off the east coast of Tor Murgos. Although, as king of an island nation, Geryon knew that the phenomenon was not unusual, he nonetheless felt a certain sense of superstitious apprehension when he saw that the surface winds were moving westward, while those aloft, as proclaimed by the movement of the clouds, moved east. He had seen this happen many times before, but this time he could not be positive that the weather was responding to natural causes or to something else. Idly, he wondered what those two eternal awarenesses might have done had he and his friends not found a ship. He had a momentary vision of the sea parting to provide a broad highway across its bottom, a highway littered with startled fish. He began to feel less and less in charge of his own destiny. Even as he had on the long trek to Tol Mishrak, he became increasingly certain that the two prophecies were herding him toward Khorim for a meeting that, though he himself might not have chosen it, was the ultimate event toward which the entire universe had been yearning since the beginning of days. A plaintive, "Why me?" hovered on his lips. And then Sinidra was there, burrowing under his arm as she had during those first few heady days when they had finally discovered that they did, in fact, love each other.
"What are you thinking about, Geryon?"
she asked softly. She had changed out of the antique green satin gown she had worn at the palace, and now wore a gray dress of utilitarian wool.
"I'm not really. Probably worrying comes a lot closer."
"What is there to worry about? We are going to win, aren't we?"
"That hasn't been decided yet."
"Of course you're going to win. You always do."
"This time's a little different, Sinedra," he sighed. "It's not just the meeting, though. I've got to choose my successor, and the one I choose is going to be the new Child of Light, and most probably a god. If I pick the wrong person, it's possible that I'll create a god who will be an absolute disaster. Could you imagine Silk as a god? He'd be out there picking the pockets of the other gods and inscribing off-color jokes in the constellations."
"He doesn't really seem to have the right kind of temperament for it,"
she agreed.
"I like him well enough, but I'm afraid Ul might disapprove very strongly. What else is bothering you?"
"You know what else. One of us isn't going to live through tomorrow."
"You don't really have to concern yourself about that, Geryon,"
she said wistfully.
"It's going to be me. I've known that from the very beginning."
"Don't be absurd. I can make sure it's not you."
"Oh? How?"
"I'll just tell them that I won't make the choice if they hurt you in any way."
"Geryon,"
she gasped.
"You can't do that. You will destroy the universe if you do."
"So what? The universe doesn't mean anything to me without you, you know."
"That's very sweet. But you can't do it. You wouldn't do it anyway. You've got too great a sense of responsibility."
"What makes you think you're going to be the one?"
"The tasks, Geryon. Every one of us has a task. Some of us more than one. Belgorath had to find out where the meeting's going to take place. Velvet had to kill Herakin. Even Sadi had a task. He had to kill Naradus. I have no task, except to die."
Geryon decided at that point to tell her,
"You did have a task, Tsenedra, and you did it very well."
"What are you talking about?"
"You wouldn't remember it. After we left Kel, you were very drowsy for several days."
"Yes, I remember that."
"It wasn't because you were sleepy. Zandramos was tampering with your mind. She's done it before. You remember that you got sick on your way to Rakhaga?"
"Yes."
"It was a different kind of sickness, but it was Zandramos again. She's been trying to take control of you for more than a year now."
Tsenedra stared at him.
"Anyway, after we left Kel, she managed to put your mind to sleep. You wandered off, and out there in the forest, you thought you met Errol."
"Errol? She's dead."
"I know, but you thought you met her all the same, and she gave you what you thought was our baby. Then this supposed Errol asked you some questions, and you answered them."
"What kind of questions?"
"Zandramas had to find out where the meeting was supposed to take place, and she could not go to Kel. She posed as Errol, so she could ask you those questions. You told her about Perivore, about the map, and about Coram. That was your task.
I betrayed you?
Her look was stricken.
No, you saved the universe. Zendromas absolutely has to be at Coram at the right time. Somebody had to tell her where to go, and that was your task.
I don't remember any of this.
Of course not. Aunt Paul erased the memory of it from your mind. It wasn't really your fault, and you'd have been overcome with remorse if you'd been able to remember what happened.
I still betrayed you.
You did what had to be done, Zenedra.
Geryon smiled a bit wistfully.
You know, both sides in this have been trying to do the same thing. We, and Zandramas, of course, have been trying to find Coram, and to keep the other side from finding out where it is so that we can win by default. It was never going to happen that way, though. The meeting absolutely has to take place before Saradus can choose. The prophecies weren't going to let it happen any other way. Both sides have wasted a great deal of effort trying to do something that simply could not be done. We should have all realized that from the very beginning. We could have saved ourselves a lot of trouble. About the only consolation I have is that Zandramas wasted a lot more effort than we did.
I am still certain that it's going to be me.
Nonsense.
I just hope they let me hold my baby before I die,
she said sadly.
You are not going to die, Zenedra.
She ignored him.
I want you to take care of yourself, Geryon,
she said firmly.
Be sure that you eat right. Dress warmly in winter, and make sure that our son does not forget me.
Zenedra, will you stop this?
One last thing, Geryon,
she plowed on relentlessly.
After I've been gone for a while, I want you to marry again. I don't want you moping around the way Belgorath has for the last 3,000 years.
Absolutely not. Besides, nothing's going to happen to you.
We'll see. Promise, Geryon, you weren't meant to be alone, and you need somebody to take care of you.
Have you almost finished with this?
It was Poledra. She stepped out from behind the foremast in a businesslike way.
It's all very pretty and sweetly melancholy, I'm sure, but isn't it just a trifle overdramatic? Geryon is right, Zenedra. Nothing is going to happen to you, so why don't you fold up all of this nobility and put it away in a closet someplace?
I know what I know, Poledra,
Zenedra said stubbornly.
I hope you won't be too disappointed when you wake up the day after tomorrow and find that you are in perfect health.
Who's it going to be, then?
Me,
Poledra said simply.
I've known about it for over 3,000 years now, so I have had time to get used to it. At least I have this day with the ones I love before I have to leave for good. Zenedra, that wind is very chilly. Let's go below before you catch cold.
She's just like your Aunt Paul, isn't she?
Zenedra said over her shoulder, as Poledra firmly led her toward the stair leading below decks.
Naturally,
Geryon called back.
It started, I see, Silk said from not far away.
What started?
The gushy farewells. Just about everybody is convinced that he is the one who won't see the sun go down tomorrow. I'd imagine that they'd all come up here one by one to say goodbye to you. I thought I'd be first, sort of get it out of the way. But Zenedra beat me to it.
You? Nothing could kill you, Silk. You're too lucky.
I have made my own luck, Geryon. It's not that hard to tamper with dice.
The little man's face grew reflective.
We've really had some good times, haven't we? I think they outweigh the bad ones. And that's about all a man can hope for.
You are as maudlin as Zenedra and my grandmother were.
It does sort of seem that way, doesn't it? And that's very unbecoming. Don't be too sad about it, Geryon. If I do happen to be the one, it should spare me the discomfort of making a very unpleasant decision.
Oh, what decision is that?
You know my views on marriage, don't you?
Oh, yes. You have spoken on the subject many, many times.
Silk sighed.
Oh, that to the contrary. I think I'm going to have to make up my mind about Lyselle.
I wondered how long that would take you.
You knew? Silk looked surprised.
Everybody knew, Silk. She set out to get you, and she did exactly that.
That's depressing. To get trapped, finally, when I'm in my dotage.
I'd hardly say that you're that far gone.
I must be, even to be considering something like this, Silk said moodily. Lyselle and I could continue to go on the way we have been, I suppose, but sneaking down hallways to her bedroom in the middle of the night seems a little disrespectful for some reason, and I'm too fond of her for that.
Fond?
All right, then, Silk snapped. I'm in love with her. Does it make you feel better to have me come right out and say it?
I just wanted to get it clear, that's all. Is this the first time you have admitted it, even to yourself?
I have been trying to avoid that. Do you suppose we could talk about something else?
He looked around.
I wish he'd go find another piece of air to fly in, he said in a grouchy tone of voice.
Who?
That blasted albatross. He's back again.
Silk pointed. Geryon turned and saw the white sea bird with its enormous wings on station once more just ahead of the bowsprit. The cloud bank to the west had grown more and more purple as the morning had progressed. And against that backdrop, the snowy bird seemed almost to glow with an unearthly incandescence.
That's very strange, Geryon said.
I just wish I knew what he was up to, Silk said.
I'm going below. I don't want to look at him anymore.
He took Geryon's hand in his.
We've had fun, he said gruffly. Take care of yourself.
You don't have to leave.
I have to make room for all the others waiting in line to see you, Your Majesty, Silk grinned. I think you're in for a depressing day. I'm going to find out if Belden's found an ale barrel yet.
With a jaunty wave, the little man turned and went to the stairway leading below. Silk's prediction proved to be all too accurate. One by one, Geryon's friends came up on deck to take leave of him, each firmly convinced that he would be the one to die. All in all, it was a very gloomy day. It was almost twilight when the last of the self-composed epitaphs had been completed. Geryon leaned on the rail, looking back at the phosphorescent wake glowing behind their ship.
Bad day, I take it.
It was Silk again.
Dreadful. Did Belden find any ale?
I don't recommend any of that for you. You will need your wits about you tomorrow. I just came up to make sure that all the gloom your friends have been piling on you doesn't make you start thinking about drowning yourself.
Silk frowned.
What is that? He asked.
What's what?
That booming noise. He looked toward the bow.
There it is, he said tensely.
The purple sky had turned almost black with the onset of evening, a black pierced here and there with patches of angry red, the light of the setting sun glowing through the clouds. There was a rusty-colored blur low on the horizon, a blur that seemed to be wearing a white necklace of frothy surf. Captain Kreska came forward with the rolling walk of a man who spends little time ashore.
That's it, good masters, he told them. That's the reef.
Geryon stared out at the place which is no more, his thoughts and emotions stumbling over each other. And then the albatross gave a strange cry, a cry that seemed almost triumphant. The great pearly white bird dipped its pinions once, then continued toward Kurram on seemingly motionless wings. Chapter 19.
Oskatat, the seneschal, moved with a certain deliberate speed through the corridors of the Drojum Palace toward the throne room of Urgot, High King of Tol Mirgos. Oskatat's scarred face was bleak, and his mind was troubled. He stopped before the closely guarded door to the throne room.
"I will speak with His Majesty," he declared.
The guards hastily opened the door for him. Although by mutual agreement between himself and King Urgot, Oskatat still bore only the title of seneschal, the guards, like everyone else in the palace, recognized the fact that he was second only to the king himself in authority in Tol Mirgos. He found his rat-faced monarch in light conversation with Queen Prala and Queen Mother Tamazin, Oskatat's own wife.
"Oh, there you are, Oskatat," Urgot said. "Now my little family is complete. We've been discussing some extensive remodeling of the Drojum Palace. All these jewels and the tons of gold on the ceilings are in terribly bad taste, wouldn't you say? Besides, I need the money I'll be able to get for all that trash for the war effort."
"Something important has come up, Urgot," Oskatat told his king.
By royal command, Oskatat always called his king by his first name in private conversations.
"That's depressing," Urgot said,
sprawling deeper into the cushions on his throne. Tar Urgos, Urgot's supposed father, had scornfully rejected such comforts as cushions, preferring to set an example of Murgo hardihood by sitting for hours on cold stone. About all that brainless gesture had gained the Mad King had been a fistula, which had added quite noticeably in the later years of his life to his irritability.
"Sit up straight, Urgot,"
Lady Tamazin, the king's mother, said absently.
"Yes, mother,"
Urgot replied, straightening slightly on his throne.
"Go ahead, Oskatat," he said. "But please drop it on me gently. Lately I've noticed that important things usually turn out to be disasters."
"I've been in contact with Shahab, chief elder of the Dagashi," Oskatat reported. "At my request, he's been trying to pinpoint the location of Agachak the Hierarch. We have finally found him, or at least found the port he sailed from when he left Tol Mirgos."
"Astonishing," Urgot said with a broad grin. "For once you've actually brought me some good news. So Agachak has left Tol Mirgos. We can hope that it's his intention to sail off the edge of the world. I'm glad you told me about this, Oskatat. I sleep much better now that that walking corpse no longer contaminates what's left of my kingdom. Were Jahab's spies able to find out his intended destination?"
"He's bound for Meloria, Urgot. Judging from his actions, he appears to believe that the Sardian is there. He went to Tol Mardu and pressured King Natal into accompanying him."
Urgot suddenly laughed uproariously.
"He actually did it!" he exclaimed with delight.
"I don't quite follow you."
"I suggested to him once that he take Nathal instead of me when he went after the Sardian. Now he has saddled himself with that cretin. I'd give a great deal to listen to some of their conversations. If he happens to succeed, he will make Nathal over King of Angarak. And Nathal can't even tie his own shoes."
"You don't actually think Agachak will succeed, do you?"
Queen Prala said, a slight frown creasing her flawless brow. Queen Prala was several months gone with child, and she'd taken to worrying about things lately.
"When?"
Urgot snorted.
"He hasn't got a chance. He has to get past Belgarion first, not to mention Belgorath and Polgora. They'll incinerate him."
He smiled sardonically.
"It's so nice to have powerful friends."
He stopped, frowning slightly.
"We really ought to warn Belgarion, though. And Kaldar," he added.
He sprawled down into his cushions again.
The last we heard, Belgarion and his friends had left Rakhaga with Karzakath. Our best guess was that they were going to Malzeth, either as guests or as prisoners.
He pulled at his long, pointed nose.
I know Belgarion well enough to know that he's not the sort to stay a prisoner for very long, though. Zakath probably knows where he is, however. Oskatat, is there any way we can get a Dagashi to Malzeth?
We could try, Urgot, but our chances of success wouldn't be too good. And a Dagashi might have some difficulty getting in to see the Emperor. Zakath's got a civil war on his hands, so he's likely to be a bit preoccupied.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Urgot tapped his fingers on the arm of his throne.
He's still keeping abreast of what's happening here in Tol Murgos, though, wouldn't you say?
Undoubtedly.
Why not let him be our messenger to Belgarion, then?
You're moving a little fast for me, Urgot,
Oskatat confessed.
What is the nearest town occupied by the Malorians?
They still have a reduced garrison at Rakhtaha. We could overwhelm them in a few hours. But we have not wanted to give Zakat any reason to return to Tol Murgos in force.
Urgot shuddered.
I am very strongly inclined toward that line of thinking myself, he admitted. But I owe Belgarion several favors, and I want to protect my brother as much as I can. I'll tell you what you do, Oskatat. Take about 3 army corps and run on down to Rakhtaka. Malorians out in the countryside will run off to Rakhaga to pass the word on to Kalzakath that we are beginning to attack his cities. That should get his attention. Mill around outside the city for a while. Then surround the place. Ask for a parley with the garrison commander. Explain the situation to him. I'll compose a letter to Kalzakath pointing out a certain community of interest in this affair. I am sure he does not want Agachak and Maloria any more than I want that old magician here in Tol Murgos. I'll suggest in the strongest terms that he pass the word on to Belgarion. The word he'll have already received about our hostile actions will guarantee that he will at least look at my letter. He'll get in touch with Belgarion, and then we can both sit back and watch the Godslayer solve our problem for us.
He grinned suddenly.
Who knows? This might even be the first step toward a reconciliation between his imperial implacableness and me. I really think it's time for Angoraks to stop killing each other.
Can't you squeeze any more speed out of her?
King Anhag demanded of Captain Greldick.
Of course, Anhag, Greldick growled. I could crowd on more sail and we'll be as swift as an arrow for about 5 minutes. Then the masts will break and we'll go back to rowing. Which shift should I put you down for?
Greldick, have you ever heard the term lese majesty?
You've mentioned it frequently, Anhag, but you should take a look at maritime law sometime. When we are on board this ship and at sea, I have even more absolute authority than you've got in Val'Alorn. If I tell you to row, you will row or swim.
Anhag walked away, muttering curses under his breath.
Any luck?
Emperor Varana asked as the Ilorn king approached the bow.
He told me to mind my own business, Anhag grunted. Then he offered to let me man an oar if I was in such a hurry.
Have you ever manned an oar before?
Once. Kerricks are a seagoing people, and my father thought it would be educational for me to make a voyage as a deckhand. I didn't mind the rowing so much. It was the flogging that irritated me.
They actually flogged the Crown Prince?
Varana asked incredulously.
It's very hard to see an oarsman's face when you're coming up behind him, Anheg shrugged. The oarsmaster was trying to get more speed out of us. We were pursuing a Tolnedrin merchantman at the time, and we didn't want her to reach the safety of Tolnedrin territorial waters.
Anheg, Varana exclaimed.
Oh, that was years ago, Varana. I've given orders now that Tolnedrin vessels are not to be molested. At least not in the sight of witnesses. The whole point of this is that Greldik's probably right. If he puts on all sail, the wind will uproot his masts and you and I will both wind up rowing.
We don't have much chance of catching up with Barak then, do we?
I'm not so sure. Barak's not nearly as good a sailor as Greldik is, and that oversized tub of his isn't very responsive to the helm. We're gaining on him every day. When he gets to Meloria, he's going to have to stop in every port to ask questions. Most Melorians wouldn't recognize Geryon if he walked up and spat in their eyes. Keldar is another matter, though. I understand that the little thief has branch offices in most of the cities and towns in Meloria. I know how Barak thinks. As soon as he gets to Meloria, he's going to go looking for Silk, since Silk and Geryon are obviously going to be together. I don't have to ask about Silk, though. All I've got to do is describe the seabird to waterfront loafers in just a few towns. For the price of a few tankards of ale, I'll be able to follow Barak wherever he goes. Hopefully we will catch up with him before he finds Geryon and ruins everything. I just wish that blind girl had not told him he could not go along. The fastest way I know of to get Barak to do something is to forbid him to do it. If he was with Geryon, at least Belgoroth would be there to keep him under control.
How do you propose to stop him, even if we do catch up with him? His ship may be slower than this one, but it's also bigger, and it carries more men.
Greldik and I have worked that out. Greldik's got a special piece of equipment in his forward hold. It bolts to the bow of this ship. If Barak refuses to come about when I order him to, Greldik's going to ram him. He won't go very fast in a sinking ship.
Anheg, that's monstrous.
So is what Barak's trying to do. If he succeeds in breaking through to Geryon, Zandromas will win, and we will all end up under the heel of somebody worse than Torak was. If I have to seek Seabird to do that, I'll do it 10 times over.
He sighed.
I'll miss my cousin, though, in case he gets drowned, he admitted.
Queen Porin of Dresnia had summoned Margrave Kindon, the chief of her intelligence service, to her private chambers that morning, and issued her commands in no uncertain terms.
Every one of them, Javelin,
she had said in a peremptory tone.
I want every single spy out of this wing of the palace for the rest of the day.
Porin, Javelin had gasped. That's unheard of.
Not really. You just heard it from me. Tell your people to sweep all of the unofficial spies out as well. I want this wing of the palace totally unpopulated within the hour. I have spies of my own, Javelin. And I know where all of the usual hiding places are. Clean out every one of them.
I am bitterly disappointed in you, Porin. Monarchs simply don't treat the intelligence service in this fashion. Have you any idea of what this is going to do to my people's morale?
Frankly, Kindon, I couldn't care less about the morale of your professional snoops. This is a matter of supreme urgency.
Has my service ever failed you, Your Majesty?
Javelin's tone had been a bit offended.
Twice, that I recall. Did not the Bearcoat infiltrate your service? And did not your people fail abysmally to warn me about General Haldar's defection?
Javelin had sighed.
All right, Porin. Sometimes a few minor things have escaped us.
You call Haldar's going over to the Bearcoat minor?
You are being unnecessarily critical, Porin.
I want this wing cleared, Javelin. Would you like to have me summon my son? We will draw up a proclamation making the prohibition against spying on the royal family permanent.
You wouldn't.
Javelin's face had turned absolutely white.
The whole service would collapse. The right to spy on the royal family has always been the highest reward for exemplary service. Most of my people jump at the chance.
He frowned slightly.
Silks turned it down 3 times already, though, he added.
Then clear them out, Javelin. And don't forget the closet hidden behind the tapestry in the corridor just outside.
How did you find out about that?
I didn't. Kiva did, actually.
Javelin had groaned. A few hours after that, Porin sat impatiently in her sitting room with her son, King Kiva. Kiva was maturing rapidly now. His voice had settled into a resonant baritone, and a downy beard had begun to sprout on his cheeks. His mother, in somewhat marked contrast to most regents, had been gradually introducing him into state councils and negotiations with foreign powers. It would not be long now until she could gently guide him to the forefront and gradually withdraw herself from unwanted positions of authority. Kiva would be a good king, she thought. He was very nearly as shrewd as his father had been, and he had that most necessary trait in a reigning monarch. Good sense. There was a rather heavy-handed pounding on the sitting room door.
Yes?
Porin replied.
It's me, Porin, a brash-sounding voice said. Yarblek.
Come in, Yarblek. We have got something to talk about.
Yarblek pushed the door open, and he and Vela entered. Porin sighed. During the course of her visit to Garog Nadrak, Vela had reverted. She had shed the shallow veneer of gentility Porin had labored so long to create, and her garb indicated that she had once again become the wild, untamable creature she had always been before.
"Watch out a rash, Porin,"
Yarblek said gruffly, dumping his shabby felt coat and shaggy hat in the corner.
Your messenger almost killed his horse getting to me.
Something urgent has come up,
the Queen of Dresnia replied.
I think it concerns us all. I want you to keep it in strictest confidence, however.
Confidence? Yarblek laughed derisively. You know there aren't any secrets in your palace, Porin.
There is this time,
Porin said a bit smugly.
This morning I ordered Javelin to clear all of the spies out of this wing of the palace.
Yarblek grinned.
How did he take it?
Badly, I'm afraid.
Good. He's been getting just a little too sure of himself lately. All right, let's get down to business. What's this problem?
In a moment. Did you find out what Drosta has been up to?
Of course. He's trying to make peace with Zakath. He's been dealing at a distance with the Malorian who is in charge of their Bureau of Internal Affairs, Braedor, I think his name is. Anyway, Drost has been letting Malorian agents funnel through Garog Nadrak to infiltrate the West.
It was Yarblik's tone of voice more than anything that warned Porin that there was more.
All of it, Yarblek. You are holding things back.
Yarblek sighed.
I hate dealing with a clever woman, he complained. You seem so unnatural for some reason.
Then he prudently skipped out of the range of Vela's daggers.
All right, he gave up. Zakath needs money and lots of it to deal with the wars he's got on 2 different fronts. Drosta's cut the import duties on Malorian carpets, at least to the merchants who pay taxes to Malzeth. Those Malorians have been scalping silk and me in the Arindish markets.
I assume you took advantage of that information.
Naturally,
he thought a moment.
Here's your chance to make a tidy profit, Porin, he suggested. Drosta's cut the import duties to the Malorians by 15%. You could raise your duties by the same amount. You'll make money, and Silk and I can stay competitive.
I think you're trying to swindle me, Yarblek, Porin said suspiciously.
Me?
We'll talk about it later. Now listen very carefully. This is the reason I sent for you. Barak, Mandoralan, Hetar, Leldoran, and Ralg are sailing to Meloria. We're not entirely positive, but we think they plan to intrude themselves in Belgarion's quest. You were there at Rehon, and you know what the Dalesian Sires told us. Those hotheads absolutely have to stay out of it.
I certainly agree about that.
How fast can you get a message to your people in Meloria?
A few weeks, maybe a little faster if I make it a top priority.
This matter has the highest priority, Yarblek. Anheg and Varana are chasing Barak, but we cannot be sure they will catch him in time. We have to delay Barak, and the best way to do that is to feed him misinformation. I want you to instruct your people in Meloria to tell Barak lies. Keep him going off in the wrong direction every chance you get. Barak will be following Keldar, so he'll be checking in at every one of your branch offices in Meloria for information. If Keldar and the others are going to Magaren or Pendaka, have your people tell Barak. He's going to Maldaria.
I know the procedure, Porin, Yarblek said.
He squinted at her speculatively.
You'll be turning authority here in Thrasnia over to His Majesty here fairly soon, won't you? He asked her.
In a few years, yes.
When this business in Meloria is concluded, I think Silk and I might want to have a long discussion with you.
Oh?
What is your feeling about accepting a junior partnership in our operation, after your obligations here in Boktor have all been satisfied?
I'm very flattered, Yarblek. What possessed you to raise such a possibility?
You are very shrewd, Porin, and you've got all sorts of contacts. We might even be prepared to go as high as a 5% share.
Absolutely out of the question, Yarblek,
King Kiva interrupted surprisingly.
The percentage would have to be at least 20.
20?
Yarblek almost screamed.
I have to protect my mother's interests,
Kiva said blandly.
She won't always be young, you know, and I would hate to see her spend her declining years scrubbing floors.
This is highway robbery, Kiva.
Yarblek's face had turned bright red.
I'm not holding a knife to your throat, Yarblek, Kiva said. It might really be better in the long run if Mother went into business for herself anyway. She should be able to do very well, particularly in view of the fact that all members of the royal family are exempt from Thrasnian import duties.
I think you'll just stab yourself in the hand, Yarblek,
Vela smirked.
As long as you're getting bad news today anyway, I might as well add my share. When this is all over, I want you to sell me.
Sell you? To whom?
I'll tell you when the time comes.
Has he got any money?
I really don't know, but that doesn't matter. I'll pay you your share of the price myself.
You must really think a lot of him to make that kind of an offer.
You have absolutely no idea, Yarblek. I was made for this man.
We were told to stay here at Tusk,
Braedor said stubbornly.
It was before this long silence,
General Ateska said, nervously pacing up and down in the large pavilion they shared. Ateska wore his uniform and his gold-inlaid steel breastplate.
The Emperor's well-being and safety are my responsibility.
They're as much mine as they are yours.
Braedor was absently rubbing the furry tummy of the half-grown cat lying ecstatic in his lap.
All right. Why aren't you doing something about it, then? We haven't had word of him in weeks. Not even your intelligence network can tell us where he is.
I know that, Tatiska, but I'm not going to disobey an Imperial command just because you are getting nervous or bored.
Why don't you stay here and take care of the kittens, then?
Ateska said acidly.
I'm going to move the army out tomorrow morning.
I didn't deserve that, Ateska.
Sorry, Bredor. This long silence is making me a little edgy. And I'm losing my grip on civility.
I'm as concerned as you are, Ateska,
Bredor said.
But all of my training rises up in protest at the notion of flying directly in the face of an Imperial command.
The kitten in Bredor's lap nuzzled at his fingers affectionately.
You know, he said, I think that when His Majesty returns, I'll ask him if I can have this kitten. I'm really growing rather fond of her.
That's up to you, Ateska said. Trying to find homes for 2 or 3 litters of kittens every year might keep you out of trouble.
The broken-nosed general tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe.
How about a compromise?
He suggested.
I'm always willing to listen.
All right. We know that Irvon's army has largely disbanded. And there's fairly strong presumptive evidence that Irvon is dead.
I'd say so, yes.
And Zandramos has moved her forces into the Dalesian protectorates.
That's what my people report.
Now then, we are both senior officials in His Majesty's government, aren't we?
Yes.
Doesn't that mean that we are expected to use our own initiative to take advantage of tactical situations that arise in the field without consulting Malzeth?
I suppose so. You have spent more time in the field than I have, though.
It is standard practice, Bredor. All right, then. The Shiva is virtually undefended. What I'm suggesting is that we restore order across the river in Paldain and move in to occupy the Shiva. That way, we cut Zandramos off from her base of support. We set up a main line of resistance along the edge of those mountains to repel her forces if they try to return. We will have effectively brought those 2 provinces back under Imperial control. We might even get a few medals out of it.
His Majesty would be rather pleased if that happened, wouldn't he?
He would be overjoyed, Bredor.
I still don't see how occupying the Shiva is going to get us any closer to locating His Majesty.
That's because you are not a military man. We have to keep track of the enemy. In this case, that means that the Shivan army. Standard military procedure in such situations is to send out patrols in force to make contact with the enemy to determine his strength and probable intentions. If those patrols should just happen to encounter the Emperor in the process, well...
He spread his hands eloquently.
You would have to brief the officers in command of those patrols rather thoroughly,
Bredor pointed out cautiously.
A green lieutenant might get flustered and blurt out things we'd rather not have the Emperor aware of.
I said, patrols in force, Bredor.
Ateska smiled.
I was thinking along the lines of 4 brigades. A brigade is commanded by a colonel. and I have got a number of fairly intelligent colonels.
Brador grinned at his friend.
When do we start?
He asked.
Did you have anything planned for tomorrow morning?
Nothing that I can't postpone,
Brador said.
But why didn't you know it was coming? Barak demanded of Drolag, his bosun.
The two of them stood on the aft deck with the wind-driven rain sheeting almost horizontally across the rail to tear at their beards. Drolag mopped at his face with one hand.
I haven't got the faintest idea, Barak, he admitted. That leg has never failed me before.
Drolag was one of those unfortunates who at some time in the past had broken one of his legs. In Drolag's case, it had happened in a tavern brawl. He had discovered, not long after the bone had knit, that the leg was extraordinarily sensitive to weather changes. He was able to predict the onset of bad weather with uncanny accuracy. His shipmates always watched him very closely. When Drolag winced with every step, they began searching the horizons for oncoming storms. When he limped, they shortened sail and began rigging safety lines. And when he fell down with a surprised cry of pain, they immediately battened down all the hatches, rigged the sea anchor, and went below. Drolag had turned a temporary inconvenience into a lifetime career. He always commanded top pay, and nobody ever expected him to do any real work. All he had to do was pace the deck where everybody could watch him. The miraculous leg even made it possible for him to predict with some degree of certainty just exactly when a given storm would hit. But not this time. The storm that swept the seabirds' decks with wind and pelting rain had come unannounced, and Drolag was as surprised by its arrival as any man on board.
You didn't get drunk and fall down and break it again, did you?
Barak demanded suspiciously. Barak had very little knowledge of human anatomy, except about where to hit someone with an axe or to run a sword through him that would have the desired and usually fatal results. The big red-bearded man reasoned somewhat foggily that if Drolag had achieved his weather sensitivity by breaking his leg, a second break might very well have taken it away again.
No, of course I didn't, Barak, Drolag said disgustedly. I'm not going to risk my livelihood for a few tankards of bad ale.